This is Dr. Howard, founder and formulator of Balance of Nature. We're changing America one life at a time.
He is right now in treatment for aggressive brain cancer. So far in his 6 weeks treatment with chemo and radiation, we're on week five, and his numbers, his labs, are astounding every doctor standing there. We just came back today from the 5th week lab report, and they just don't even know how his labs are looking this good. So I know it's a combination of things. However, one of the key components is Balance of Nature.
From now until April 21st, receive a 20% discount and free shipping on any first order of Balance of Nature. Again, this special radio offer will only be available through April 21st. Call 1-800-246-8751 or go to balanceofnature.com.
To take advantage of this special offer, use the special promo code PODCAST.
You don't talk like a bigot.
So my parents raised me together when they were married, and then they divorced when I was 10.
Can you tell me a little bit about...
After that, my father dated and remarried.
Why you started to engage?
But soon after their divorce, my mom fell in love with another woman, and they've been together ever since.
In a culture as politically polarized and aggressively tribalized as ours, how do people change their minds? I'm Georgie Borman, a mother and cultural commentator born and raised on the West Coast. I want to know what we can learn from people who've been on both sides of contentious issues, whether they end up on the right or the left. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the 180 Cast.
Really reticent to engage in the sort of national dialogue on this. So what prompted you to go from, I'm just going to keep this to myself, to I really have to speak out about this? Hello, welcome back to the 180 Cast. I am your host, Georgie Borman. Today we have a fairly contentious issue that we're going to deal with. This is a hot button topic. Obergefell v. Hodges, which declared same-sex marriage to be a constitutional right, was decided in the summer of 2015. Now you might be thinking, that's a few years ago. Why are we still talking about this? And indeed, people have made it a point to say to me, well, it's the law of the land now. And they've just kind of encouraged me to move on to other issues, right? That's the practical, responsible thing to do. It's like it's been decided. It's in the books. What more is there to say? Well, it turns out that there's actually a lot more to say and a lot more to be decided in this new world. Regardless of where you, the listener, stand on the issue, I think we have to admit that in redefining marriage, we've redefined family from what we've heretofore understood it to be, which is the union between a man and a woman, which naturally, generally produces children and nurtures them. That's what marriage and family is designed to be at its core. So I have a family, you listening at home have a family, and we have deeply held convictions about how we were raised, and for those of us who want kids or have kids, we have convictions about how we want to raise our own kids, who will rear them, who will teach them, who will they know and be connected to, who's going to influence them. Basically, what kind of future do we want for our kids? What kind of safety and security, both mentally and physically, do we want to provide for the next generation? So, due to the existence of medical interventions like IVF, donor conception and surrogacy, these are policy concerns about how children's life, how their lives begin and how they're raised and by whom. So for same-sex couples, when they decide to have children, they're usually produced through one of these methods, which means that not only do they not know at least one of their biological parents, they also don't experience the complementary nature of the mother-father dynamic. Now, obviously, it's coming across that I am biased on this issue, and I am biased. But regardless of where you stand on the issue, I think we need to talk about this because how we affect the next generation is a big deal. I think that's something that we can all agree on. Perhaps no one understands this issue quite like my next guest. She is intimately acquainted with both sides of the issue of gay marriage and gay parenting. Katie Faust is the director and founder of the children's rights organization Them Before Us. She is a fellow Washingtonian like myself and the Washington state leader of Canavox. Katie, thank you so much for letting me pick your brain today.
So good to talk with you.
So, like I said, I think you know better than most anybody sort of both sides of the issue. Tell us a little bit about your background. Who raised you? What was your view of gay families growing up? And how did you think about your family in particular as a kid?
So my parents raised me together when they were married, and then they divorced when I was 10. After that, my father dated and remarried. But soon after their divorce, my mom fell in love with another woman, and they've been together ever since. So they have been an integral part of my life as a child, adolescent, young mom, and now mom, you know, more established mom. They're a welcome and frequent part of our life, my life, my kids' life. I don't say I was raised by two moms because my father remained involved in my life to my great benefit until he passed away 3 years ago. And so, you know, you mentioned the different ways that that homosexuals become parents. And the biggest way is the old-fashioned way, where they have kids with an opposite-sex partner and then later mm-hmm. choose to get into a same-sex relationship. And so that's kind of the crop of kids today, you sure. know, who are old enough to talk about this. That's mostly, you know, been their experience where they began in a heterosexual marriage or relationship. And then later on, their parents, maybe soon, maybe immediately, moved into having a same-sex relationship. But so that was my world. I split time between my mom and dad. Thankfully, they remained friends after the divorce, so I didn't have to lose a relationship with either of them. Both of them understood how important the other parent was to me, which was a gift, because I really needed both of them. You know, my mom and her influence was irreplaceable in my life. I wouldn't be the woman I am today without her, but it's the exact same thing for my dad. He had a really, even though my mom and her partner had a very stable, low conflict relationship where there was lots of love and lots of stability when I was at their home, they could not give me what my father could. And so I was definitely like in high school for sure. I had a different view and a different opinion about marriage and same-sex relationships. And I would have been much more in support. Like if it had been a political issue at the time, I would have been more in support of gay marriage as policy. You know, things started changing when I was in college in terms of like looking at the importance of marriage as an institution and mothers and fathers in the lives of children. And then I got into the adoption world and worked at the largest Chinese adoption agency in the world and with kids who had experienced loss of both of their parents. And then I started working with kids who, you know, doing youth ministry. And I'll tell you what, like some of the greatest pain that anybody experiences is the loss of a relationship with their mom or dad. I mean, you get right down to it, and it doesn't matter how that loss takes place, you know, death, abandonment, you lose touch with one parent after a divorce. And now working with a lot of donor conceived kids, and it doesn't even matter how well loved you are by the parent who remains. There's often a wound there, and it's so tender, and it can last your whole life. And so, you know, I that's where it kind of crystallized for me. Like there is so much pain for kids when they lose a relationship with their mom or dad. And it's this pain that can often lead to other struggles in their life. So that's kind of the process that I went through, you know, in terms of thinking about moms and dads, and that's kind of underpins everything before I started to like write about it and speak about it.
Yeah. Going back to your time in high school, which you mentioned, you said that you would have been fairly supportive if it had been a controversial issue at the time. So what was the turning point there? Was there a precursor to before you were working with youth, where you changed sort of your fundamental opinion of same-sex relationships or same-sex parenting, or was it really that moment later on that was like, aha, I've made a transition here?
Well, in terms of that evolution on my opinion, it had a lot more to do with, and this is very common, I think very common for children of all different stripes, all different, you know, situations of family, is there is an instinctive protectiveness that children have for their parents. And I find it with kids that have experienced divorce or donor-conceived kids, you know, really struggle with this too, this idea that I have this allegiance and I have this this connection right to my parent, and I want to protect them, right? I don't want to go against them because I love them and they love me. And so that love for the parent, oftentimes when you're young and still in their home, especially, translates into, you know, I need to support them and agree with them. And a lot of it too, you know, that was a couple decades ago when the world was not as hospitable to people who were identified as gay and lesbian. And so there was a little bit of hate, you know, back off, that I felt, you know, towards my mom and her partner, who are incredible women. So there was that going on in high school for sure. And then once you leave the home and get some distance and get a little more perspective, it's easier to say, hey, I understand that marriage serves a pretty critical good for society. And I can say that and 100% still love my gay parent, both of my parents, you know, that there's no contradiction between saying, I love my gay family and friends, and this, you know, political conclusion of marriage that exists to safeguard the rights of children, that there's no contradiction there.
Yeah. And that seems to be something that people have a hard time wrapping their head around, is like, how can you love people personally, but also disagree with a policy? And it's almost like that. It's more like that every single day. It's more like whatever your politics are is also how you feel about people individually in your relationships. That's really a tough position to be in.
I agree. And it's something that I actually think that we need to be tutored on that specifically. So interesting. Two out of the last three nights I've been up in the middle of the night worrying about that very thing. Like, the tension point between desperately wanting to be a good friend, you know, to someone who disagrees with me, and they believe, you know, from their perspective, what they're hearing in their world is, if I hold these views, it's not just that I'm wrong. You know, it's not just that it's two people of goodwill who disagree. You know, from what she's hearing in her world and the circle of people that she's choosing to surround herself with, and her media sources are saying the only people that hold this position are evil people. And you can't have a conversation, you know, if that is the lens through which you are viewing interactions with people who disagree. And so this is slightly off topic, but that's why I think that, you know, identity politics are one of the most dangerous threats to the social fabric. It literally says, you know, this is my identity. And if you disagree politically, that means that you reject me, you reject my identity. And there's no basis for genuine interaction. And then the only information that you're going to get about the other side is the very worst of their position, you know, on social media. So yeah, it's difficult. And I don't know how much time you want to take talking about this, but my answer is that we find the solution to this problem when we look at the question of roles. You know, what is your role as a friend? You know, that your role as a friend is not necessarily to go in there, you know, with your sword, you know, pulling out your sword at every minute and saying, I want to argue about this. There's judgment and justice,
right,
and all of this in your friend relationship, right? The role of a friend, compassion, support, bearing one another's burdens. There are times to have difficult conversations, but that's not what friendship is primarily about. It's about connection. Now, when you talk policy, the goal of policy is not empathy and connection, right? Policy is, and that role is the role of authority as a voter, right? And your aim is justice. And so you have to wade through policies that are going to maximize justice. especially justice for the most vulnerable, which is actually what the marriage debate is about. It is about justice for the most vulnerable. And so too often we switch those roles and we say, I'm going to bring justice and judgment to my friendships, but I'm going to use policy for love and compassion. Both of those have a role in society. Both of those have a place, but you've got to put them where they belong, right? Just uncompromising justice in policy and the most lavish sacrificial support and compassion in our friendships.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up identity politics because your first site was called Ask the Bigot, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So you don't talk like a bigot. Can you tell me a little bit about why you started to engage? Because it seems like you were reticent to engage in the sort of national dialogue on this. And then, so what prompted you to go from, I'm just going to keep this to myself to, I really have to speak out about this.
Yeah. I still would love to go back in the closet. Seriously. I would love to just go back to that place where I can be friends with everybody. Mm-hmm. I am so much more a grace giver than a truth teller on that kind of spectrum. And, I would rather keep the peace, but what broke the camel's back for me was in 2012, when Obama evolved on the subject of gay marriage, to me, that was the point where there was a temperature change in the country. And I felt like the media thought, okay, now that we've got the president, now it's game on in terms of calling everybody who disagrees a bigot. And that's what I heard, that bigotry was the only possible motivation that anybody could have for support of traditional marriage. And I would have these conversations online or with friends, and I'd give them reasons, and I would talk about how important it is to be sacrificial in our relationships with our gay family and friends. But none of that mattered. You were a bigot no matter what you said and what you did and how many people that you loved, and no matter how well-reasoned and well-supported your arguments were. The bottom line is, you were a bigot if you supported traditional marriage, period. And so I kind of snapped and said, oh, I see how it is. I see. Well, I guess that I'm a bigot then, because I do support traditional marriage. I'm a massive supporter of traditional marriage. Why? Because it's a social justice issue for children. And if you get marriage wrong, then you are dooming us to a world where children are going to be starved for what they're made for. And you're not going to be able to solve any of the other major problems you have in this world unless children are being loved and known by their mother and father. And do you know how you make that happen? Marriage. Mm-hmm. So the goal of the blog was to do two things. Number one is to destroy the bigot narrative, right? By offering reasons and arguments and research and stories of kids so that people could understand, you know what, there's something pretty critical here. And it does not have to do with hatred or phobia. And the other side was to talk to Christians, especially, about how if you are hard-hearted and if you are on that soapbox, you're unbiblical. You have also got to be, you know, when your gay friends think about Christians, they should not think about you in terms of moral policing. Right. They should think about you and say, I may disagree, but man, she loves me so much. And so that's kind of how this all got started is I snapped. I snapped because, the world got it wrong. The media got it wrong.
Yeah. At a certain point, you on that scale, I'm very similar to you in that I would really just like everybody to get along. You probably wouldn't know it from my writing, but I really would just rather everybody get along, and I would rather write silly articles about leggings and things like that. But it's like, no, at a certain point you have to wade into the fray. Okay. So you mentioned Christianity and you mentioned justice, and you also talked about purpose for children and what they're designed for. I want to go back just a little bit to, how did you arrive at these arguments? Because I know that the arguments that you that you make in the media are secular. They don't rely and say, they don't, you know, go to this verse and say, well, the Bible says this and, you know, X, Y, Z. And so this is the right thing to do. So how did your arguments evolve? Because I was watching one of your interviews. I think it was ABC Australia, where they did ask you about, becoming a Christian in high school. So how does that relate to the arguments that you make now? Like, if that hadn't happened, would you still eventually get to the point where you're at and the arguments that you're making?
Mm-hmm. I set out to, when I am talking about policy, I actually don't think it's appropriate to use scripture. I don't, because that is not the common authority. I'm not going to use scripture to somebody who doesn't recognize scripture as their authority. In fact, I think it's unfair and it's incredibly ineffective. And so what you have to do is you have to appeal to the common authority, right? And the common authority is natural law and the Constitution. And so that is where the arguments need to be made. And I think, honestly, part of the reason why we are where we are is Christians have been lazy. And they thought, oh, I can say God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, and that's going to do it. Mm-hmm. Instead, it takes a little more work than that. So from the time I started writing, I've never used biblical arguments to support my stance on marriage policy. Now, of course, there's no conflict between that, but the reason why, like what really, really pushed me over the edge and why I decided to have the focus on children on my blog is because what I heard the gay lobby saying leading up to Obergefell is that mothers and fathers are optional and kids don't care if they've lost a relationship with their mom or dad. And that's why I said, now you're just lying about kids. I have worked with enough kids who have cried enough tears over their missing parent. And I've worked with those at-risk populations. And you know who's overrepresented in those at-risk populations? Fatherless kids. And so now you're just lying. And so I think when I first started writing, certainly my arguments were not as well-researched or well-formed. I just thought kids need moms and dads. Mm-hmm. But the deeper I dug into the social science, the more I realized this is the bedrock of society. And not only is it nice to have a mom and dad, they literally provide different social emotional food to children. And that children who grow up without their mom or dad, I'm not saying that they are doomed. They're not. You know, we had a president who grew up fatherless, wrote a book about it, and he's incredibly successful and an incredible husband and father. And I think mm-hmm. that, you know, Obama was an example of that to so many. But are there greater struggles? Are there higher risks? Is there a deep heartache? Yes, yes, and yes. And so that's where my writing, especially in my, well, in my early blogging, but now especially in my advocacy with Them Before Us, is majoring on, let's really talk about, you know, what kids need and what they want and what they're made for and what they have a right to. And so when I'm talking to Christian audiences, I'll talk about scripture. But for Christian audiences, that is a hard message because it says you don't get to be neutral on this subject. You know, this population of fatherlessness actually deserves special recognition and protection. You should be going out of your way to not only help fatherless children, but prevent fatherlessness and motherlessness to begin with. So as a children's rights advocate, we major on studies, statistics, and arguments. And we also, you know, one thing that is incredibly important to our organization is sharing the stories of kids, sharing the stories of kids who have lost a relationship with their mother or father due to donor conception, divorce, abandonment, or because, you know, they have same-sex parents. Because that was a major thing that was missing in our run-up to Obergefell, is those voices of kids were really hard to find because it's very expensive for them to talk about it.
Yeah, I've read some of those stories, and wow, if you don't feel something while reading those, I mean, it almost feels like it should be required reading for kids in school. It's that important to hear from their perspective. I heard one person said something really interesting. She said something along the lines of, you know, my mom told me I was so wanted. I was so desired. And she said, think of it this way. If you want so badly a genetic connection to your child. Well, think about the child. Don't they also want a genetic connection to their parents? I just thought that that was a perspective that I probably wouldn't have heard of from anybody who hadn't been in that position.
Right. And that's what we really try to do is all of these questions. I mean, think about the last article that you read from the New York Times, you know, touting the advantages of open marriages. And, you know, think about the stories about celebrity divorces, or think about, you know, the last time you heard about somebody who's coming out and leaving their marriage because now they've discovered their true self. Or think about the infertile couple who wants to have a child but can't do it unless they use a surrogate. I mean, what do all of those stories have in common? They obsessively focus on what the adults want. And that is always how we've talked about questions around marriage and parenting and family. But the reality is, all of these questions should revolve around the rights and needs of children, because they're the ones who are primarily affected. But nobody's doing that. Nobody is saying, wait a second, let's look at this from the child's perspective. And so that's what you're going to find on our website, is we are child-centric, probably to a fault. You know, we major on the child's stories. We talk about children's rights. We talk about children's needs. All, you know, we want people to see this through the eyes of the kids, because they are the ones that don't have a voice. They can't blog about it. They can't form a lobby, you know, and so that's what we want. We want people to say, look at this from the kid's perspective. And when you do that, those arguments look a lot different.
Yeah, it's interesting, because it seems like no matter what side you're on, when we're talking about justice, we don't pull any punches. Like, it is such a big deal. And I think that's something that everybody should be able to get on board with from the, you know, social justice warrior who's, you know, 22 and on campus, or somebody like you who's basically a veteran in this sphere of hashing it out on policy. It's like, we all care about what is our concept of justice, and how do we get it? I read your open letter to Justice Kennedy back from 2015, and I'm just going to read this line really quick. When it comes to procreation and child rearing, same-sex couples and opposite-sex couples are wholly unequal and should be treated differently for the sake of the children. That is not pulling a punch.
And the line right before that said, when it comes to their dignity, when it comes to their ability to love and commit, there's no difference.
Yeah.
And so we're not talking about whether or not these are second-class citizens, you know, which, oh my gosh, please, like, stop, right? It's not right. That you're less than, you don't have this capacity, you don't have this dignity, none of that. It's saying that there is one area where these two couplings do not offer the same thing. And it happens to be the area for the whole reason why government recognizes marriage to begin with, right? Marriage is recognized by government not so that the man and the state can put its stamp of approval on your love life. You know, when Congress passed DOMA back in 1993, you know, they said, quite simply, government has an interest in marriage because it has an interest in children. The only relationship. Like, what is marriage from a children's rights perspective? Because Christians know about marriage from a religious perspective, and the world tells you that marriage is just about, you know, with whom you share love and commitment. What is marriage from a children's rights perspective? Marriage is the only relationship where the two people that children have a natural right to come together. That's it. And that's why it deserves special recognition and protection. But what you do when you legalize gay marriage, right? You redefine marriage, and then you redefine parenthood. When husbands and wives are optional in law, mothers and fathers become optional in law as well. And we have seen that since Obergefell. Right now, there's no longer a political institution in the United States that says that children should have a mother and father. Right. To do so constitutes discrimination, to say that children should have a mother and father. That is why you're seeing two women listed on birth certificates, because they're saying, hey, Justice Kennedy said we're entitled to the full constellation of benefits as heterosexual couples. Heterosexual couples get to be on their child's birth certificate. Can we? Despite the fact that birth certificate is supposed to exist to serve the child. It's not an instrument of adult intent. You know, that's why you see all of these different states scrubbing the terms mother and father, husband and wife from their parenthood laws. Because now just recognizing that children do have or should have a mother and father is unconstitutional. So that's the problem. That's the problem with equating two things that are different, right? Like two men can have the same level of love and commitment that I can have with my husband, but what my husband and I offer our children is different than what, you know, two men or two women can offer to children. And so that's the biggest, you know, that's why gay marriage is such a big deal. It's because it's trickling down to parenthood laws, and the government now legally is declaring mothers and fathers optional. The problem is that when it comes to what children want and what is in their heart, their own mother and father are not optional.
I have a slightly hypothetical question to ask you. Do you think that you would have become this sort of natural family advocate if you had grown up in a traditional family? Like, where do you think you'd be now? How does your specific background impact the way you do things? Would you do them differently if your parents had never gotten divorced?
I don't know, because I don't think that I'd have a very special story, honestly. I'm really just a child of divorce who has a mother who happens to be in a gay relationship. And so really what that taught me was that you can love, be committed to, believe that those people are irreplaceable in your life, and recognize that moms and dads matter. I don't know, because all of these different experiences, you know, working with adopted kids and, you know, seeing the process of adoption and understanding the loss that, you know, springs from adoption for children, and working with youth who have suffered through family brokenness, completely unrelated to, you know, same-sex parenting issues, which, by the way, let me just say, you know, we've talked a lot about gay marriage and same-sex parenting because that's so prominent in the news and in our public discourse right now. Gays and lesbians are not responsible for the abysmal state of the family in the United States. Heterosexuals
are. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Right. Heterosexuals are. And this whole process of the legal departure of recognizing that children should be with their mom and dad, that didn't start with gay marriage. That started with no-fault divorce. And when you're talking about surrogacy and questions like reproductive technologies, the biggest user of those technologies are heterosexual couples, right?
Yes.
Or heterosexual singles. And so this is not about the gays, you know, this is about, are adults asking children to sacrifice their fundamental rights so that adults can have what they want? And there are a lot more heterosexual couples that are guilty of that than gays and lesbians.
Oh, by far.
Yes. And that mentality began, you know, in the sexual revolution, when we completely disconnected sex from marriage and commitment. And children have been paying the price ever since. So circling back to your question, I don't know. But I do know that I can empathize with adults. I can empathize with adults who are struggling through a difficult marriage or who are suffering from infertility. I mean, it's so hard. And I can empathize with my friends who experience same-sex attraction and are looking down the road at their life and wondering, you know, what is my life going to be like? And those are very real, powerful, human questions and struggles that, as a friend, you need to offer empathy and compassion, but on a policy level. Every question about marriage and family and parenthood must bow down to the rights and needs of children, period. And if we don't, children suffer this incredible lifelong injustice.
So we've seen quite Well, like you mentioned, the sexual revolution, I think it sounds like we've been on the road to 2015 and beyond and where we are now for a very long time. And support for same-sex marriage and same-sex families has risen pretty dramatically. So there's a lot of people that you meet in your day-to-day life, I'm sure you especially, that are like, I don't see what the big deal is. It sounds like they're equal to me. So if you had somebody sitting across from you that's like, I just disagree. They may or may not call you a bigot, but let's just say they're reasonable and they say, I just really disagree. And I don't see how a mom and a dad is any different from a father and a father, or a mother and a mother. I don't see why that is more suitable for children. So what is, lay out for me, what is the most persuasive argument, or what would you start with?
I'd look them in the eye and I'd say, did your mom and dad love you? Were they in a committed relationship with one another? Did you enjoy a warm, close connection to both of them? And if they said yes, I'd say, that's awesome. Which one of them was optional for you? Which one could you have done without? Did they offer you the same thing or not? And that half of the population would say, well, no, they were both pretty important to me, and my mom and dad were really different. And I think that they both kind of, I benefited from the distinctly gendered parenting that I received from them. And I'd say, yeah, that's right. Because that's exactly what the nature of fathering and mothering is. That sociologists, many will say, there's no such thing as parenting. There's only mothering and fathering. That's how different mothers and fathers are. And if I asked that question to somebody and I said, did you have a relationship, close, loving relationship with your mother or father? And they're the other 50% of the population. And they said, no, my mom ran out on me when I was three. And my dad raised me and he worked really, really hard. And he was such a good dad. I'd say, did you love that your mom was gone? I mean, I wouldn't say it like that, but did you love it? Do you feel like it was no big deal? Or was it one of the most painful things you've ever suffered in your entire life? I've had people that will say, well, my mom and dad were married, but my dad like completely ignored me. And I just felt like I was invisible to him. And I said, did you love that? Wouldn't you rather have had him love you and connect with you and come to your baseball? Yeah, because you're made for that. And so when we look at our own lives, most of us will say my own mother and father weren't optional, either because I desperately needed both of them and they gave me what I needed, or I missed out on relationship with one or the other. And it resulted in a lot of pain. So you can answer that question just by looking at your own life. Or you can answer that question by looking at the data that we've compiled over decades of studying family structure. And, you know, the greatest objection that I often hear in my work is kids don't need moms and dads. They just need to be safe and loved. Mm-hmm. And I say, oh, congratulations. You've just said that children should be raised in the home of their married mother and father. Because statistically, the very place where children are the most likely to be safe and loved is being raised by both biological parents in a married home. And I can say that as an adoptive mom, right? That even adoptees who are going into homes that have been screened and vetted and that are supervised, they don't even fare as well as children who are raised by their biological parents. And so I think that that's an argument that goes against both personal experience and the very best social science that we have.
Wow. That's a really heavy conversation to have. I've never thought of it that way.
Yeah, it's intense, right? And like, why is it intense? What we're talking about, like ultimately, these are questions of what does it mean to be a human child? What does it mean to be a human child? When you are disconnecting children, especially when you're casually disconnecting them from one parent to whom they have a natural right, you're kind of messing with the nature of what it means to be a human and certainly what it means to be a child. And then you get into these realms of reproductive technologies, and you are teetering on the edge of messing with the dignity of personhood. So it's deeply personal because we are talking about existential questions.
Yeah. Speaking of existential questions, I don't know if you got this email, but a reader reached who reads my stuff at The Federalist, he reached out to me and he had this very, very interesting question that he said that he was also going to ask you. And that is, what if technology gets to a point, which it seems like we're almost there, where same-sex couples can use only their DNA to create a child and then gestate that either in gestate that child in an artificial womb or via a surrogate, but it's their child, like they are the only biological parents. Does that change any of your arguments?
Yes. Okay. So fascinating that you happened to ask me this question. Right before we got on this call, I was talking with one of my advisors, Jeff Schaefer, who works at ADF, smart guy. And, you know, we were talking this through and this very, very question, right? Because it's a good question. But let's first be clear. This is completely theoretical. Mm-hmm. While there have been some tests that have been done in mice, doing something like this in humans is still in the realm of science fiction, right? And so we are now projecting far, far in the future. But let's just say that something like that is possible. So we are already in, when we're talking about IVF and reproductive technologies and donor conception, right? We are already, I would say, in the place where we are manufacturing children, especially when it comes to surrogacy, right? That we are assembling sperm and egg and womb. Oftentimes the sperm and egg is being chosen from a literal catalog where you can decide, do I want a donor with blue hair? Do I want somebody with a PhD? I want somebody that's of Iranian descent. We are already manufacturing children right now, but at least what we're doing is seeking to replicate the process of a natural birth in the sense that one, a man's seed is coming together with a woman's seed, and then we are producing a child from it. So I would say we are already in the place where we are treating children as products. And a lot of the children who are produced through those processes would tell you that themselves. They would say, I feel like a product. I feel like I was commercialized. I feel like I was commodified. You know why? Because they were. And that's how they feel. The fact that money is changing hands in a lot of this adds to that feeling of commodification. But when you get to the point where you are using genetic materials from two same-sex adults, now we're not even trying to replicate a natural process.
I see.
Now we are just at the place where it is wholesale child production. And, you know, my advisor, Jeff Schaefer, you know, said, you may as well just like create a neighborhood of humans where you're just borrowing genetic material here and there with no even expectation that there is going to be some kind of their dignity being honored. So when you get to the point where you are creating children through processes that are so outside of the order of humanity, right? What humans are ordered towards, you have a lot bigger problems than just, you know, to whom does the child belong? Now you're like in full scale sci-fi. Are we just going to mass produce children in artificial wombs? Now, artificial wombs are actually, I think, a lot closer on the horizon than children of same-sex parents. And oftentimes I wonder, man, why did I get into this whole discussion about marriage and parenthood? I feel like when it was too late to make a difference. And I think it's because in another decade or so, we will be seeing children created. There's a possibility that we are going to have factories of artificial wombs where we are gestating children. Because right now in that ART world, the most expensive part of the process is getting a woman to rent her womb. And wouldn't it be so much more cost effective if we could just cut out the female altogether in that process, the woman, the gestating woman in that process? So there is so much on the horizon that people, most Americans, I think, if they knew what was going on, they would be concerned about. But it requires looking at things from the child's perspective And that makes demands of us. It makes demands in terms of what we're willing to speak out about, but it also makes demands on our personal life. You know, like if we are going to recognize that children have a right to both their mother and father, recognize that that's what they need, recognize that there's incredible loss for children when they don't have it. Well, that's kind of an indictment on how a lot of Americans are living today, right? Because many people are not honoring the needs of their own children. So it's pretty high stakes, you know, personally and on a policy level.
Yeah, these are big ideas. I wrote a year or two ago a very long, in-depth piece about artificial womb technology, because I think it, like you said, it's right over the horizon. I'm like, oh, we need to be thinking about these things right now. We need to be figuring it out and thinking ahead on, you know, what's most important. And that's, for the record, that's why I love science fiction so much. And that's my favorite genre, is because people are always trying to think ahead and think, what if? So I really appreciate that you really leaned into answering that question, because that was really helpful. Wow. These are really big ideas.
Mm-hmm, they are big and personal, you know?
Yes. Big and personal. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me on the 180 cast today. It's such a contentious issue, and I really appreciate like your level-headedness and your empathy on this topic. That's so hard to find. And so that's why I was especially excited to have you on the podcast, because you just have that sort of peacekeeping balance with justice that's just really, really hard to find. Again, for the listener at home, if you're like sitting there and you've made it to the end of this podcast and you're just fuming and you're like, Katie's so wrong, and you know, I used to be of that perspective, and I grew up in a Christian home or whatever, and I don't believe that anymore, and she's just wrong, and here are all of the reasons why, come talk to me. Hit me up on Twitter at 180cast, and we can have a conversation about that. I am very eager to have all sides of the issue exposed, and if you've been on both sides of an issue, I want to hear from you. So again, you can follow the podcast on social media at 180cast. If you like the podcast, regardless of whether you agree with our guest or not, you can give it a review on iTunes. That would really help us out in being able to reach more people like you with thought-provoking conversations just like this one. And you can send me your feedback again at 180cast. You can also follow me at Georgie_Borman on Twitter. If you want to keep up with my other content and hear my thoughts on a myriad of issues, I write weekly for The Federalist as a senior contributor. Until next time, seek the truth, share your values, and listen with your heart and your mind. God bless.